Welcome to Enabling Automation. I'm your host, Ben Hope. Today's episode is another installment in our Careers in Focus series, where we sit down with people whose careers have helped shape both ATS and the automation industry. My guest today is Javin Taylor. Javin has spent more than 31 years at ATS. He joined the company in 1995 after studying electrical engineering at the University of Waterloo, beginning his career as a controls engineer. Over the years, he's held roles in software development, product management, project management, operations, commercialization, technical sales, and today serves as a staff specialist. Along the way, Javin played a key role in the development of Max and SuperTrack Conveyance, where he led the early software development. This conversation isn't simply about job titles or technologies. It's about how an engineer's perspective changes over time, how building software becomes building products, products become platforms, and experience becomes pattern recognition. Javin, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So Javin, you joined ATS in 1995. Take us back to the beginning. How did you end up studying electrical engineering at the University of Waterloo and eventually joining ATS?
Well, it was a long path. I got interested in the electrical behavior, I guess, electronics through high school. Went to Dorchester High School. They had tech courses. I took electronics and really loved it. And then my dad actually was building a log cabin and was about 17 years old, and he let me wire the entire cabin. And I mean, he obviously gave me a lot of guidance.
Yeah,
he gave me a lot of guidance, but he let me do the entire wiring, and that actually got me really interested in, I'll say, electrical behavior. And I decided I wanted to go into electrical engineering or technology. I applied to Conestoga, but I also applied to Waterloo, Carleton, and Queens, and ended up getting accepted to all of them. I wasn't convinced I was going to get accepted to Waterloo because of the high grade marks that they required, but I got accepted and I jumped at it.
Wow, cool. And what was ATS like when you first walked through the doors in 1995?
It was like brand new. They had just moved into the Royal Oak facility. It felt like it started at a new business.
Cool. And then the work itself, what was that like?
I'm going to say that they took a chance on me because coming out of university, I had studied basically high voltage with kind of a minor in controls. I thought for sure I was going to be working in hydro. I had to rework terms in hydro. I expected to get a job, but when I graduated, they were not hiring, and in general, just wasn't hiring. So I couldn't wait for them. So I applied in controls. I went to an interview with Rob Hall, Jeff Wilson, and hit it off. I mean, they took a chance on me because my only real controls experience was General Motors in 1992. And, you know, it was pretty limited. So it worked out very well. They offered me a job, and Hydro then offered me a job the day after I signed with ATS.
Really?
And I just stuck with ATS. When I say I'm going to do something, I'm going to do something.
Yeah, cool. Okay. And you started out as that controls engineer. What did the job actually look like at that time?
Jump in with 2 feet is really what it was. Like, I worked with some of the other senior controls people to learn about the programming style, things like that. But I wasn't there for more than a couple months before I had my own project that I had to program. It was small. It was a small project. But once that one was successful, the next one was actually, in my mind, was a fairly big project, and did the entire programming on my own. I had a lot of guidance. I mean, there's people at ATS that I would credit with my success.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give a shout out to Mark Johannesson, Dennis Murray, Vince Mock. They really helped me succeed, I'll say.
As a young engineer, what did you think you were good at, and what did you quickly realize you still had to learn?
As a young kid, I'll say you think you're good at everything. You know it all in those days, but it became very evident. My experience, that little bit of experience that I had in my first work term at General Motors, did not qualify me for PLC programming and machine integration. It was a humbling experience. I needed a lot of help, I'll say, in the first months at ATS.
Yeah. But it's usually an invigorating experience when you have a lot to learn and there's new experiences.
It was new. It was exciting. Yeah. It's keeping you engaged and thinking about it in the evenings, you know, all these cool things that you're doing. I can remember one time doing my first project was an installation in London, Ontario. And I ended up staying with my parents overnight rather than going to a hotel.
Yeah.
Right. I stayed with my parents, and I remember pulling out the old, I can't call it a laptop, it was a luggable, and I'd set it up on their kitchen table, and I was working on the program at night. And it was just fun.
Yeah.
It was just fun. It was new.
Just what you wanted to be doing.
Yeah.
So you started by solving individual machine problems. At some point, your thinking shifted towards solving problems once and reusing those solutions. And I think this is where the story really begins. So how did you become involved with standard products at ATS?
Well, it was an evolution I mean, ETS has always been promoters of standardization. Mm-hmm. Even in those early days, I would say the standards weren't set or anything, but the programming standards, the code modules that we were using, it was about following, you know, what somebody else has already done on another project, right? And taking that, trying to maintain as much of a similar code structure as possible and integrating that machine. So we did that. I did PLC programming for a few years. And then as the controls group grew, we all reported to Rob Hall, was our controls manager at that time. And the team grew. They decided to implement team leads. So the idea was, you know, that the team lead would help manage a group of people so that Rob Hall didn't have so many direct reports. And I don't know if it's luck or why specifically, but I ended up under Albert Kleinekink, who was in the Winder group, or he was developing software for Winders. And I ended up getting involved in Max, that you mentioned earlier, modular ATS control system. I ended up getting involved in that. And after the Winder group that I ended up joining the formal standard products group.
So you mentioned there was already a belief in standardization and reuse at ETS. And at that time, like the standard products, did you have to try to convince the rest of the company to utilize? Because maybe a background on standard products, like they did everything from little brackets or kind of sensor brackets, mounting things that are reused time and time again, all the way up to kind of more advanced technologies, right?
Yeah, I don't think that there was any convincing required. I think ATS really has always grasped the fact that standardization is going to help you save cost and time in projects.
Yeah.
Klaus Warner was a huge advocate for standardization. And like you said, we had all kinds of standard products, maybe more standard designs than anything. But the idea was that it's reuse.
Yeah, people were all on board. When did you first realize that we shouldn't be solving the same engineering problems over and over and over again? Before standard products or...
Oh yeah, before standard products, I would say even, you know, before the Winder group, in that, you know, we were programming machines, they have certain sequences they go through, using the same structure for how we implement a structured sequence of events, fault handling, that kind of thing. It became, I wouldn't say routine, but it certainly became easier to think about a complex machine in broken down segments of PLC code. Right. So you could break it down easier. You could standardize on it. So it probably wouldn't have called it standardization back then. It was probably not until we got into the Winder group that standardization really took hold in my mind, is what a standard is.
And how powerful it could be. So we've talked about the history of SuperTrack before on the podcast, but I'd like to hear what it was like from the perspective of someone who was building it back in the day. So what was your role on the original SuperTrack development team?
So in the early days, I'll say around 1999 or 2000, we got involved, or I got involved with SuperTrack at a high level. I was more helping with integration of SuperTrack into like a show machine, that kind of thing, right? So it was more the PLC programming end. After helping out with the PLC development, we got involved at a more in-depth level with Agile Systems, which was one of our partners for developing the electronics and the magnetic coil arrangement. And it was decided at one point that we were going to take over the development. And it was at that point, based on, I guess, my history with the modular ATS control system, somewhat embedded programming, that I was going to be the lead on the software development as we took it over. And so then it became one or more of the developments that I was working on. It wasn't a full-time job.
Yeah. So you led the software development then, and what were you actually trying to make the system do? Like, what was your goal?
So make it usable. The initial product that was, I'll say, planned as a beta product, it was just not usable. It required, you know, creating text files in a specific, very, very specific format, and then converting them or compiling them into hexadecimal and then loading them into flash chips. Very, very manual.
So you needed a certain expertise to be able to use it at the start.
Yeah, the expertise was beyond me. I could never do it.
Yeah.
Correctly the first time. It took me a lot of time. I said, this is not usable. We'll never be able to have
to sell it.
Other people within ATS use this product in its current form.
And what were some of the hardest technical problems the team had to solve back then?
probably our biggest challenges were around the encoder feedback of the system.
Mm. And what did you get wrong early on?
Got a lot of things that weren't ideal. There was things that I probably got wrong as far as how to best configure a track. I mean, there was definitely issues around releasing software maybe too quickly, right? I think that happened a fair bit in the early days because we're like, you know, new product, we're trying to quickly fix things. We'd release a new firmware revision and then find out, oh, well, we broke two other things, right? And yeah. So, you know, I think getting things wrong in the release process was pretty common in the early days.
Lots to learn. Was there ever a point where you genuinely questioned whether this technology was going to work?
I think you know this, don't you? Yeah. We started out with an encoder technology, an optical encoder technology that had a very tight reading range, I'll say. And we struggled with machining tolerances in order to make sure that the optical encoder strip would be in a certain range. And it seemed like we were always chasing issues. We'd solve it in one spot and then we'd go fix it in another spot. And all of a sudden the problem would go back to the first spot again. We were continually chasing problems. And I think at one time I said something to the effect that this is never going to work. I told you that. But ultimately, we actually do have one of those systems still running in the field today with that encoder system. So we did actually get through the major hurdles, but we did find a better optical encoder solution that gave us a better reading range and just made things more tolerant, made it easier for the end user. They didn't have to do a whole lot of setup. So we did solve the problem.
Yeah. I think every technology and development goes through that phase where you get so frustrated at some point that you just reach that point of, this is never going to work. I want to give up. But you never do give up.
We didn't have that option.
You didn't have the option.
If you recall, we were working on actual projects with actual commitments to customers. So, but it was stressful in those early days. The very first projects were stressful.
Yeah. When you're building something completely new, how do you know whether you're facing a temporary engineering problem or whether the fundamental idea itself is wrong? Kind of linked to the last question a little bit. Or do you know? Or do you just have faith?
Well, I think... you know, eventually it becomes adoption. I think if there's enough grasping of the technology, or maybe it's adopting the technology or commitment to the technology, maybe that's a better way to word it. Like, you know, you think about SuperTrack in the early days, we actually committed to selling this on multi-million-dollar machines, right? So the problems that we encountered, they had to be temporary, right? We had to solve them eventually.
And Klaus would be coming down every so often to question whether the problems were solved.
Yeah, yeah. Klaus liked to check in on things on a fairly frequent basis, especially SuperTrack. It was one of his babies.
Yeah, yeah. Do you remember the first moment when you saw SuperTrack working and thought, wow, this is different. This could be something special.
Yeah, I do. It would have been actually prior to beta version SuperTrack.
Okay.
We had a beta version. Again, this was before I had taken over the software development. It was a beta unit, and we actually shipped it to a beta customer in Texas. They offered to do an evaluation of the product and see how they might use it in their application. Similar to the challenges that we were having, we really struggled to get that to run reliably before we shipped it. We installed that machine, we got it running, and we left it for, I think it was 2 or 3 weeks, and it ran flawless.
Wow.
For 2 to 3 weeks. We were all pretty shocked because we knew the challenges that we were still facing before we went to a production version. But that fact that it wowed the customer and it ran flawlessly really said, hey, you know what? This can work. If we can get some of these bugs worked out so that they're not coming up all the time.
We have something pretty special.
Really cool.
And kind of moving from technology to product, this is where your career takes an interesting turn. You move from developing technology to thinking more kind of about products. And those things obviously always aren't the same thing. So why did you move from software development into product management?
We went through a restructuring after Klaus passed away in 2005. We had some new management. There was a lot of restructuring happening. And most people that were in managerial roles interviewed for their position and interviewed for alternate positions. So it was basically trying to figure out where is, each person best suited. So even though you've worked your way to a certain point in your career, maybe you're better off over in this department, right? So it was really a rethinking of our organizational structure. And at that time too, we were going through a lot of cost considerations, you know. So I interviewed for my role essentially, and the product development role, and it was better suited that I was a product manager. And because we had also decided to reduce our development budget, there was unfortunately some other people that were let go. So I was asked to be product manager for the Superbots, the Pick and Places, the Feeders, and Supertrack. So that did mean stepping away from a primarily software development role.
And was it difficult to move away from kind of hands-on development and kind of hands-on work to a different kind of work?
Absolutely. Yeah. I probably never fully went away from it. I always tried to stay a little bit in touch with the technology. From Supertrack perspective, I always said that there wasn't a screw changed or a dimension changed on a drawing I didn't know about for years and years and years. I like to stay right in touch with all the details, even though it wasn't my responsibility to be involved at that level all the time.
But some you had a good kind of perspective from multiple angles to understand if this is going to be valuable or it could cause problems down the road. And how did becoming a product manager change the way you looked at Supertrack?
Cost and schedule would probably be the things that come to mind right away, because in the development stages, especially the early years, never got pushed on timing or cost. It was always, you know, get it done as quickly as possible, but I wasn't worried about costs.
Yeah.
You know,
just get it to work as best
as soon as you become the product manager, now you're worried about, you know, how long is it taking to do something? What are your commitments? What are your costs? Right. And so
when did you realize that making the technology just kind of work wasn't enough? You needed to be more than that?
Probably in the product management role. It's like I tell people with the Supertrack, we didn't set out to develop a linear motor, like a linear servo motor. We set out to develop an automation solution for conveyance, right? So it's not just about what does that technology do, you know, to move an actuator. It's more about how can we make automation simpler for the integrator.
Mm. And kind of next question, which is I think very relevant at ATS, is what is the difference between a successful engineering project and a successful product?
Well, that's a tough one. I think the engineering project is successful when you've eliminated all the bugs at the end. You've basically checked all the boxes on the requirements that the end customer has put in front of you. The successful product is that we're anticipating the customer needs. We're checking the boxes before the customer even asked for it. That's maybe the way I'd put it.
Kind of leads into the next question. Is there anything that you learned from customers about the product that you hadn't maybe understood properly as an engineer?
Yes, specifics are going to be difficult. It kind of goes back to, you know, developing a linear servo motor versus an automated solution. It's providing detailed specs isn't always what the customer wants. They think about it differently because they don't understand the product at the detail level, right?
They understand the high-level application.
Understand the high-level application. They ask questions differently. You know, what seems obvious for an engineer is not obvious to the end user.
Hmm. And then kind of moving to commercialization, it's one thing to invent something. It's another thing entirely to make it repeatable, scalable, and successful across an organization. So what did project management, operations, and commercialization kind of teach you?
Well, product management definitely taught me to think about the finances of the product. Commercialization taught me to listen to the end customer, listen before speaking.
Moving on to technical sales. So working directly with customers changes the way you think about engineering. Suddenly you're solving business problems just as much as technical ones. Did you ever imagine yourself working in technical sales?
I don't think I would have called it technical sales. I think from the early stages of Supertrack specifically, because it was a very small team, that I think in a lot of ways we were doing some level of technical sales. It was convincing. And in the engineering days, you know, we're convincing more on specs and longevity of the product, things like that. Probably wouldn't have called it tech sales. I think it really became technical sales when it became less engineering work for me and more time spent with the ATS sales team in answering customer questions. And then it became very obvious that spitting out, you know, specifications was not what they wanted to hear.
It's not going to help.
I mean, it's important. It's important, but you can spit out velocities and accelerations in 30 seconds, and then you move on to how does this product actually benefit you?
It's following more of a traditional sales process, just in a technical kind of state of mind.
Yeah.
What makes a technical person good at selling, do you think?
Listen first, understand what is the customer actually asking, and then answer second.
What do you think engineers typically get wrong when they try to explain technology to customers?
Oh, it goes back to spitting out
specs.
Data, specs.
Specs, or too much information.
Overwhelming technical details to an audience that is maybe not familiar at the level that we are. Mm. I mean, that's something that I've had to learn over the years, is to think about it more from an end user's perspective that's not familiar with how a servo motor works.
Yeah, yeah. Because everyone's probably been through that experience where you're presenting to a group of people something technical, and then you're looking around and everyone's falling asleep. And it's never the greatest feeling in the world when you're giving a presentation. How did speaking directly with customers change the way you understood SuperTrack?
Well, that's what got me turned around to, let's talk about the SuperTrack with how it can benefit your application. Mm. Right. What features can we provide to you, or do we have embedded in a product that's going to make your life easier, make your machine run more reliably, save you time on integration, as opposed to spitting out those specs again?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And after seeing so many automation applications, what do you see today that you wouldn't have seen when you were 25 in the industry?
I think it's the fact that things are changing so constantly and so rapidly, and they continue to do so. It's pretty amazing to me that the changes never seem to stay static for very long.
Mm. Things are always moving. And then kind of moving to kind of reflection. After hundreds of automation projects, experience becomes something different than knowledge. It becomes almost a perspective. So after 31 years, do you solve problems faster, or do you simply recognize them earlier?
I would say you recognize gaps in a theory or a project. You understand the technical gaps quicker. Challenges that they're at this point, if I'm seeing them as a technical problem, it's probably more challenging to solve. So I don't think we solve them any quicker. But you can definitely see through past experience that there's a problem here, but we solved it this way. So you can maybe guide the rest of the team through a problem quicker. But those, I wouldn't even call them problems anymore, because we already know how to solve them.
Yeah. It's just kind of a challenge that you've encountered, you've solved it, and now how to understand when you encounter similar problems again and utilize similar solutions.
Similar problems, it's not really a problem anymore. It's when you find something new, those are probably going to be very challenging to solve. So I don't think problems are actually solved quicker.
Are there any mistakes you've watched the industry repeat?
In general, not necessarily like in my world, but just generally, I think sometimes technologies are held on to for too long, right? Not jumping into, or not grasping that this technology is antiquated and we need to move on. I've seen some design specs that have come from customers like, we haven't done that in 10 years, right? But they've held on to these technologies and these specifications for too long.
It's their comfort zone.
So their comfort zone.
It's like anything, like you got to get out of your comfort zone if you want to move forward. Yeah. Okay. How do you know when to push an idea and when to maybe just walk away?
Yeah, that one's tough. I would say, you know, I've had ideas that I like to push, and sometimes not everybody is on the same bandwagon. So I've, you know, you wait until you can build up your use case portfolio and say, okay, this idea could have been used in these different applications, right? And try to push it forward that way. So maybe it's just step back for the moment. I mean, maybe you come to realize that your idea is, not going to work. So then you just drop it.
Yeah, yeah.
But sometimes you just walk away for the moment and build up a case for it.
And kind of connected to that, has your relationship with technical risk changed throughout your career? Do you have more of an appetite than maybe you did early?
I think you could look at that two different ways. I think in the early days, I would not have been scared of any risk. I would have just jumped in. But I wasn't responsible for cost and schedule, right? And that's where that new perspective of being project management or product management comes into play. So in the early days, no fear of risk.
When you have infinite time and infinite
Exactly.
Money.
So, you know, once you get the other elements to your career in place, you know, especially, you know, project management, then all of a sudden technical risk becomes schedule risk, becomes cost risk.
Yeah.
And so maybe a little bit, I'm more fearful of it now than I would have been when I was younger.
In your kind of observation, what do younger engineers tend to underestimate?
How long it takes to do a development.
Mm.
We still do that when we get older too.
Yeah. 2 weeks should be fine.
Yeah, exactly. It often takes a lot longer to do a development than what you think.
Yeah. And is there anything that you've learned from younger engineers in their approach to the job?
You know what? I like working with younger engineers because they're enthusiastic and they're optimistic, and it helps me stay that way too, because sometimes you get a little pessimistic because you know all the roadblocks, you know all the hurdles in, you know, just working through, I'll call it bureaucracy. Right.
Yeah.
Within the company.
Yeah.
And, you know, the young engineers just don't have that when they come in.
So that kind of excitement rubs off on you. Is there anything that you can see now that you simply couldn't see 30 years ago?
Well, first of all, that I'm still here. I did not anticipate that. I honestly thought that there'd be other careers that would evolve over time.
Mm-hmm.
I think what has happened at ATS has been that constant evolution of change that I guess I've been fortunate enough that the change has been positive for the most part through everything that I've had to go through. You know, I think that there's people that would struggle with some certain changes and that would cause them to want to move on, right? I've been lucky enough that it's given me opportunities to take on different roles that have been exciting. And I don't think I would have anticipated that.
Interesting. Steve Wardell actually said something very similar to that, because he's had a number of different roles within the company, but it's the same company. But he said it's almost been multiple different careers.
Yeah, it's been
with the same
careers.
Company, and it hasn't been boring for a second.
Right.
Right. When you think about the next generation of engineers coming into automation today, what's the one thing you hope they learn earlier than you did?
I know I've said it before, but it is really listening to what the customer wants. What do they really need? And forget about don't just start spitting out technical specs. Really listen first.
Okay. Well, thanks, Jav. This has been a fantastic conversation. Your career wasn't defined by a single role. It was defined by looking at the same challenge from different perspectives. You started by learning how to control machines. Then you helped build platforms. Then you learned how to turn technology into products. And finally, you helped customers apply those products to real manufacturing challenges. It's a reminder that engineering is about much more than solving technical problems. It's about creating solutions that people can build, support, adopt, and ultimately trust. Thank you for sharing your experiences and the lessons you've learned over more than 31 years. And thanks to everyone for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode of Enabling Automation, be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, thanks for listening.